It's time for the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast.
We've got lots and lots of things to talk about and to do today.
Covering the territories from the 1940s to the 1990s.
It's the best thing going today.
Interviewing wrestlers, referees, authors, and other media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great.
The cream, yeah. The cream of the crop.
And now, here's your host, Tony Richards.
Hey there, everybody. This is Tony Richards, and I want to welcome you to our Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel podcast. On our show, we're tracking and documenting the history of pro wrestling from its beginnings through 1990, with special emphasis on the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s pre-video era. We're profiling personalities by having the authors who've studied their lives and written their stories. We're studying and revisiting territories and the booking offices that control them, historic towns where the history of pro wrestling is so deep, and the legendary buildings where the fans came to see their favorite stars and storylines play out virtually every single week. We're covering all four of these dimensions of the sport of pro wrestling, and I'm so appreciative you've decided to allocate some of your time to go on this journey with us through this show. If you like what we're doing, you might want to think about visiting my Substack channel by searching for Tony Richards 4, and there you can subscribe to my daily wrestling history newsletter, where you'll find birthdays of wrestlers past and present, an RIP salute daily to those in the business who we want to honor that have passed on, an event on that day in pro wrestling history, and much, much more. You also have an archive of this podcast and special updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book. All of that is provided for free. But I do have a special vault of writings for paid subscribers. And by subscribing to that, that helps support me and my research and the work to do all of this for you. You'll find it all on my Substack channel, substack.com. Search for Tony Richards 4 and the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. You can also follow me on X at Tony Richards 4 or join our Facebook group, Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. Okay, with all that out there, let's go to today's show and today's guest. Hey again, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Personalities, Territories, Buildings, and Towns. This is Tony Richards and our Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel History Podcast. And today, I'm excited because my guest to be on the show with me is Steve Generelli. And you have heard him on other podcasts out there in the pro wrestling podcast environment. He's a regular on John McAdams' podcast, and he also guests on plenty of others. We can talk. I'll let him tell you about that. Steve, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Tony. I'm really excited about your podcast. I know your podcast is fairly new, but I think you're really filling a void, not only providing tons of information on the territory days, but I know your producer, Jake Hammer, has come up with some really great visuals to make you feel that you're back in the territory days. And yeah, I'm really happy to be a part of your show today.
Okay, wonderful. Well, we're going to venture into some place that I am not as familiar with because I grew up in the South and we didn't get the WWWF, get all my W's in there. We didn't get the WWWF. I didn't see it until really into the late 70s when my parents got one of those big backyard satellite dishes, and right, Madison Square Garden's cards were on some of the channels. And so that was the first time I really saw it. So I'm kind of discovering some of this stuff for the first time, other than just seeing it in magazines when I'd go to the local drugstore and there'd be Bruno Sammartino on the cover, and they'd have taken an action photo of him, and he was in some kind of dire straits, you know, that you knew he was going to come out of. And so seeing it in real life actually happening was kind of exciting.
Yeah, it really is what drove me to become a fan. And I'm here, I'm a fan all these years later. I can remember the very first night I kind of became a fan. I had seen wrestling in the earlier 70s, probably around 72, 73. It was the old IWA promotion or NWF with Mighty Igor and the Love Brothers and Tex McKenzie, Mel Mascaro, a whole host of others. And I was younger then, and it was all fun. It was great. It was amusing, but it didn't really hook me in. But a few years later, And this happened to a lot of fans in the Northeast. Wrestling was on at midnight on Channel 9 out of New York, New Jersey, the WOR show. And my brother and I'm sure we watched like a Rangers hockey game and stayed up and watched SCTV and some of the other shows that were on late at night. And eventually wrestling comes on. And yeah, the show begins, and you know, for the fans that watched out of the New York program, they always would, you know, Vince would come out and introduce the show and say what was going to happen this week, but then they would immediately go to a promo for Madison Square Garden. And that always made you know that Madison Square Garden was the most important thing of all. And that particular night, I'm watching for the very first time. They're hyping this match where it was Bruno and his cousin Tony Parisi were going to face in the main event this next show, superstar Billy Graham and Ivan Koloff. And it was coming off of a big angle that they had done on the previous MSG show. So we're there. My brother and I are watching, and he didn't like wrestling. He wasn't interested, but I was hooked into this. And, you know, it was like one after another. Superstar cuts a promo, and then Koloff cuts a promo. And then it's the Grand Wizard cutting a promo. And then Albano cuts a promo. And then, you know, you're all revved up watching this. This is at midnight, but you're all revved up. You're all excited. And then the best part of all was Vince then brings Bruno out. And like Bruno is like the voice of God. Like he's just looking at the camera and he's saying how like all these guys who are like brash and loud, how he was going to shut their mouths and, you know, right the wrongs. And you're hooked and you're like, I gotta buy magazines. I gotta go to the shows. I gotta see this. And in those early days, I mean, I was a kid. I wasn't going to drive to New York or anything like that, but we were lucky enough. We did have HBO, and HBO had those early MSG shows on there. And I remember one of the first ones I saw was a month or two later when Bruno had his neck broken by Stan Hansen.
Yeah.
So those were the early days, and that's how I became addicted to this stuff called pro wrestling.
You know what I find fascinating is just listening to you tell that story about the different guys that are cutting the promos. And I don't talk about the current product much at all, just because I'm really happy talking about the historical stuff. And I don't always understand what's going on currently either. But here's what I find interesting about what you just said. The WWE today gets criticized for all the interviews.
Right.
But you just said back in the day, it was that way. Like there were interview after interview after interview building to the show and not as much match. I guess just because the show's longer now, instead of being an hour, it's a couple hours. Maybe that's the difference. But hasn't the WWWF and WWF and haven't they always kind of been built on television being more the sales part of it, and then to get you to come to the arena?
Well, definitely back in those days, it would be fair to say that the fans who were really enjoying and digging this stuff probably enjoyed the interviews more than the matches, I would say. And you have to look at it this way too. Unless you're in a big market, you're not going to see Bruno because Bruno only worked the big clubs in his second reign. So during that second reign, in smaller buildings like the building I went to in Binghamton, we had guys like TJ Strongbow or Ivan Putski, those were the headliners. And oftentimes the tag team scene would be a hot item on the TV shows that they would really emphasize the tag teams. You know, we eventually got Bob Backlund, and I was able to see Billy Graham a few times when he was champion. And, you know, Bob Backlund had no problem working smaller clubs. He'd work high school gyms. He'd go anywhere. And I'm sure Bruno was that way in his first reign too. He didn't have any hesitation to work high school gyms and stuff. But you know, when Backlund came in, we saw a lot of him. We saw a lot of Billy Graham. Those were happy times to be a fan for sure.
You bet. Well, in the spring of 75, Bruno's got a couple of feuds going, and I just kind of want to get your perspective because I'm sure these characters bled on over into the time when you started watching as a fan. One of
Sure.
those feuds is with Spiros Arion,
Right.
and I've been working with Jerry Briscoe and Bradshaw Layfield on their show, Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw, and we've been talking about Jim Barnett. And in 1965, Spiros Arion got really over in Australia. And then he comes back to the States, and he's a tag team partner with Bruno. Am I getting this story right? They were tag team partners, and then there was a split.
But, well, actually, they had been tag partners back in the late 60s, and he was always looked upon as you know, one of Bruno's strongest allies and strongest tag team partners. And I think in the 60s, the only time he really looked insignificant was they were going to set up a big match at the Garden with Bruno against the original Sheik at Farhat. And I think they had Farhat just annihilate Arion, like just knock him out in 3 minutes or less. This may have happened in Boston. I can't remember, Boston or New York. But other than that one instance, Arion was always kept super strong. He was kind of like the Greek equivalent of Bruno, this guy who was just a wrestling god, had all the holds, knew all the holes, didn't have the strength of Bruno, but he was bigger than Bruno in height. And, you know, he definitely, when they did the big heel turn with him and he turned on Bruno and Strongbow pretty much at the same time, you really had the feeling that this guy was one of the toughest threats that Bruno ever had, and he might win the title.
Yeah, I went and watched the April 14th, 75 match in the Garden, a Greek death match with Bruno and Arion. And you just get the last 3 minutes or whatever, but it's a turns out it's a submission match, right. And I'm just always amazed, no matter how many times I see it, when Bruno does anything to look to the crowd, it's like a Roman Colosseum in there, man. I mean, it's like he just holds his hands out and they erupt like, yeah, kill him or whatever, you know. It's huge. The pop is huge.
Well, he had that power. He had that power over the fans. And I mean, he even had it in the 80s when he did the comeback with Piper and Savage. I mean, basically what he would do if he had a moment of, you know, should I do this to my opponent? He'd look to the heavens almost, and they would give him this huge roar, and then he would do whatever he would do. But it was certainly not unlike what we would see from Hogan in a few years when Hogan would cup his ear to the crowd and they'd explode. It really wasn't that different. But Bruno and Hogan had huge differences, as we know. I mean, Bruno was so authentic and so real, and people had that sense of family with him, and they loved him. And Hogan was loved, certainly, but he wasn't, people didn't have that personal connection. Like, this is somebody that's a member of our family, that kind of a feeling.
Right. And the both of his feuds in the big arenas, he was doing these death matches. With Arion, he was doing a Greek death match. With Bobby Duncan, he's doing the Texas death match, gimmick match. And that seemed like a little bit of a mismatch, but it got over. But, you know,
one thing that's interesting too about this time period we're talking about, Bruno never gets credit for this, but he was his own talent scout. He was his own guy finding these opponents. And I'm referring to Bobby Duncombe. I think he had seen Duncombe on a trip to Japan, and he saw how this huge guy from Texas could move so fast, had great agility, had all the holds, had a tremendous look. And he told the elder McMahon to bring this man in. We're going to have a series of matches with him. And he was box office, and people like John McAdam and myself that grew up in the 70s, there was a famous magazine cover of, I think, of the wrestler, Inside Wrestling, probably the wrestler, and it said Bloodbath at the Garden, and it was Bruno and Bobby Duncan bloodying each other in the cover shot on the magazine, and that cover resonated for years, and that was a match that never really saw the light of day. I don't know if it was on HBO or not, but it's never appeared on a Coliseum video or on the network. So it was probably a match that never got filmed. But that was a hot feud at the time.
Yeah, Duncan didn't have any trouble getting blood. I mean, he was a true Texan.
A very good wrestler. And I got to see him in 79. They brought him in to do a run with Backlund. And in the Backlund book, they acknowledged that his knees were really, really shot at this point. But I think Bobby's wife was really ill, and he needed the money to pay the bills. And I saw Bobby Duncombe in Binghamton against Monsoon. Monsoon put him over. Monsoon was just finishing up his career then. He was kind of a stepping stone as a wrestler. And that was a big win for Duncombe to put him over. And then I saw in Binghamton, I saw Bobby Duncombe against Backlund. And I always rooted for the heels. Other than Bruno, I always liked the heels. And I rooted for Duncombe to win the title that night, and I was greatly disappointed.
Wow, that's interesting that you were a little conflicted, but you sided more on the heel side.
To be
that
a
kind
WWE,
of that kind of started happening about that time with all fans.
To be a WWF fan, I mean, there was a heavy emphasis on our three managers, Albano, Blassie, and the Grand Wizard, who all had great individual characteristics about them. And you had to love their proteges. I mean, most of them were very high caliber heel opponents. And to me, Backlund was so bland. I didn't care for him. I mean, after seeing Bruno, who was so dynamic, and even superstar Billy Graham, who had so much color, to go to Bob Backlund after those two, it kind of took the life out of me in some ways.
Now they put Albano with Duncombe.
Yes, that's true. I think in the first run, the one that we're talking about right now, it was the Wizard with Duncombe, but the second time it was Albano when I saw him in 79. But yeah, Bobby Duncombe was a very legitimate contender, maybe not at the level of Arion, but very close.
Yeah, I mean the film that does exist, the tape that does exist, is pretty amazing of those big shows with Bruno and those two guys. Now, another guy that's in the mix here that I think is not remembered today as well as he should have been is Waldo Von Erich. Did you get to see Waldo much?
I didn't get to see him much, but what I did, I really, really liked, and you're correct. I mean, I've seen it in recent years on YouTube, on these old clips and old matches, and it's amazing. I mean, it shows you how he registered with the New York crowd. I mean, he had wrestled Bruno in the Garden in 64. They had three matches together, and to think that they brought him back in 75, a dozen years later, or close to a dozen years later, it just shows you that he resonated with the audience. And there was one long, long match that they had in 75. And then the second match is the one that's on the YouTube and it's been around for a long time, about a 4-minute match. And Bruno did a blade job on his arm. And some people said he had a broken arm, and that's why the match was so short. But the heat in that match, and that match has been shown for years and years and years, but the heat of the match is just off the chain. I mean, you can almost see in the clip at the end where the referee raises Bruno's arm that it's almost like the building is shaking. It's so loud. So it's just one of those magical moments. And if people don't believe in old wrestling, or they think the old WWF was a bunch of baloney, they got to see this match just to see the reaction of the fans. And it was definitely a magical time. I mean, I was there for all the Hogan matches. I mean, I saw the pay-per-views. I saw all the big TV matches, but I never saw an explosion like that of the fans and the audience the way the Bruno Von Erich match did at the Garden.
Well, just, I talk about this quite a bit, and there's a little bit of psychology involved in it. But, I mean, as human beings, we all have recency bias, you know. Right. So the farther we get away from some of these things that you and I are talking about and that we actually experienced as our generation ages out, some of these things will be lost. And that's one of the reasons I'm doing what I'm doing, is to at least provide some kind of recorded history. I know other people are doing it too. And I think it's important because, you know, if I just think whatever wrestling you grew up with is your favorite. And it kind of stays with you. And then you add recency bias into it. Then these guys like Waldo Von Erich and Bobby Duncombe and Spyros Arion, they sort of go into the mists of time. And speaking of that, another guy that was in the mix in late 74 and early 75, still on top with Bruno's, Killer Kowalski.
Right. Killer Kowalski is one of the, one of those names, maybe on your Mount Rushmore of all-time heels. He really went back a ways with Bruno, and they had some famous matches. I think the most famous one, other than the one that's on YouTube from the Garden that we're talking about this time frame, he had a real famous match from Fenway Park in 1969. They had a outdoor match where it's a famous picture of Bruno hitting him with a wooden chair in the ring and during their match. And but they did have a long-standing feud, and apparently in real life they're very good friends. But he was one of those guys that could come back in the 60s and 70s. And I know they had some matches when he was one of the executioners in 77. But they really had a long track record together. And he was a very useful part of WWF history. And of course, he trained Triple H, so we have to give him credit for that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Killer Kowalski just. I think a lot of fans just automatically put him in the 50s and 60s, but he's still on top here in the 70s and still drawing, and he's still a big name in Japan too at this time in the 70s. He's going over there still and participating in their tournaments and tours, and
absolutely.
He had a little bit longer run than you just off the cuff think about.
Oh yeah, and one thing that I learned just from prepping for this show was I didn't know until prepping for this particular show was that him and Bruno teamed up in All Japan on one of Baba's shows around 74, 75. I mean, and this would happen later on. I know Strongbow would team with like Volkov and they'd have those weird matchups like that. But yeah, Bruno and Kowalski teamed together in Japan around 74, 75 against two of the top stars of Baba's promotion. So it's very interesting just even to try to, cope with that. That really happened.
So you mentioned the Big Chief, and he's the guy that's filling in as far as Bruno's, Bruno's working just the big cards, right? And typically then on the other shows on top, you got Chief J Strongbow or you got Gorilla Monsoon. What did you think about Chief J?
At the time, I think he was kind of like regarded as the people's champion because he was on TV all the time. And it seemed like, if the WWF was a big soap opera, then he was kind of like the victim a lot. Albano was always hurting him or hitting him with a fake cast or having the major heel of the day do a number on him. He was beloved. I mean, I know he, did his war dance and he did his chops and he did had the sleeper hold that nobody could get out of. And it was a much more simpler time, but he was just a beloved wrestler. And I saw him headline many times. I got to see him two or three times against Billy Graham in late 1977 when Billy was champion. And the matches were extremely short. They were like 3 to 4 minute long matches. But it was all Strongbow. I mean, he didn't give Billy, I mean, Billy was just selling for him just for the entire 3 or 4 minutes. And I think Strongbow, I know in recent years people have said a lot of negative things about him, that he was a difficult guy or difficult to deal with. But he definitely knew his role and he definitely knew the business inside out, obviously.
The guys that I talked to that wrestled down south when he had his run in Georgia as Joe Scarpa, and he also researching for my Dory Funk book, he had a run in Amarillo for sure. I mean, okay. They just talk about how psychologically they learned so much from his work. He knew how to work the match. He knew how to work the crowd. He knew all the babyface tricks to do to get sympathy, and and I try to suspend that recency bias again, the things that you heard about him as a road agent and those kind of things, to just think about what kind of performer he was in his context of his career. And I just hear all these wonderful things about him, and I wish there was more available to see his work from back then.
He was another one of those guys, kind of like a Bobby Heenan, in that he could always take a tremendous bump. I mean, you could throw him in the turnbuckles and he would go at the top, and he took a lot of good bumps. But you're absolutely right as far as he had we always say that Jake Roberts had great psychology. Chief J must have had the most best psychology, and Bruno too. I mean, these guys were great storytellers in the ring. Essentially, you could believe what they were doing, and they hooked you in every time. It was not like oh, you know, this feud was good or this match was good, but I've had enough. I'm gonna watch another show, or I'll watch a baseball game or something else. They hooked you to the point of you wanted to keep coming back for more, and there's something to be said for those territorial stars that can do that time and time again.
Well, Jack Briscoe said, you know, he learned how to be a babyface from Joe Scarpa, and
Really?
that's good enough for me, you know.
That's a high compliment.
Yeah, right. What I know Brian Solomon's working on his Gorilla Monsoon book. At this time in 75, how did fans look on Bruno or on Gorilla?
I asked that question to myself too. I mean, there were times, and I know we talked about this recently. He'd come out to Vince on camera sometimes, and he would almost like act like a member of the office, which he really was. And he would give updates on, well, the tag team tournament, this is going on, or if there was something involving the office, like some wrestler got suspended, he would come out and give the news. So he was like a part-time wrestler, but he was like part-time office. And but it, as a fan watching and seeing him, like for instance, like that match with Duncombe in Binghamton, you had to respect him. I mean, we knew he had this long, long history of being in the promotion, going back to the days when he was a heel in the early 60s, going against Bruno, and he was one of Bruno's most famous challengers. And again, the magazines were so important, because even in the late 70s, as a kid, I'm reading all the stuff in the magazines, the histories and the backgrounds of these wrestlers. And when you read that, Monsoon and Bruno had this long history together, you really have to respect Monsoon for surviving and enduring. And so in that time, in the mid to late 70s, he was looked at as like an elder statesman, a guy who would be really hard to beat. But once in a while, like a up-and-comer like a Bobby Duncombe could beat him, and that would really put the bloom on Bobby Duncombe, and you knew he was somebody to really be taken seriously.
I mean, we know kind of how his career played out, and he ended up being a commentator.
Right.
Do you think, and this is things that I think about and speculate on, but Vince Sr. and the powers that be at the time, do you think they were doing that intentionally, booking him as a part-time company official because they thought he was going to go that way in the next few years? They were going to work him out and work him out
Yeah,
to a
I mean, my understanding from what I've read and what I've heard, I mean, in those days, the odds probably would have been on him taking over rather than young Vince. I don't think anyone really had much faith in young Vince in those days. But you got to give Vince credit. I mean, he took Bangor, Maine, which his father gave to him. He did well with Bangor, Maine. He proved himself. When the time was right, he got the money together, and I think his father, gave him the opportunity to buy the company, and from that point forward, he was able to come through. I mean, had he reneged on one of those payments, it would have gone back to the elder McMahon, but it didn't happen. And but I'm really looking forward to Brian Solomon's book, because he'll have a lot of detail that we just don't know about right now. So I'm
You
quite
bet.
excited about that.
Yeah, they use Gorilla as a special referee in some of Bruno's matches, and he's still really over. Another guy that is on the babyface side at this time in 75 is a guy I've been around since the 50s, Haystacks Calhoun, and they're still using Haystacks in tag team
Right.
matches on top, and they're using him as a special referee, and he and Gorilla are kind of interchangeable here in these situations, it
Right.
seems like.
Right. Yeah, they were very comparable, because they were both these, super, super, super heavyweights. They're both baby faces. They both had a long track record. I enjoyed both of them. I heard Tony Garea on a recent interview said that him and Tony and Calhoun got the tag straps in around 72, because Ray Stevens and Nick Bockwinkel were supposedly coming to New York for a brief run, or a run with the tag titles. And the first I had ever heard of that, but apparently they dropped out. They said they couldn't make it. They had maybe a different commitment that they preferred to go to. Yeah, but just to think of them being in the WWF at one time, Stevens and Bockwinkel, that's very interesting. But Calhoun, like you said, he He finished out the 70s. He worked the rap until 79. But I think by the end of 79, I think Calhoun was just kind of going on fumes. Monsoon still had that gravitas because he was booked stronger and, of course, was in better shape than Calhoun. And also the gravitas from his feud with Bruno from the 60s.
I don't think Haystacks. I talked to Jerry Oates about him, and I've talked to a couple of different people that rode with him on the road, and he just didn't take care of himself very well, and that added to his size and his mobility and all those kinds of things. And he's just the reason was he was just over, as a legend at the time.
Oh, he was.
Speaking about the tag team, let's talk about the tag teams. I mean, there's three or four really good tag teams in the WWWF in 75, starting with, and I had Evan Ginsberg on not long ago, and that was the first Madison Square Garden card he saw. He said his most vivid memory was the Valiants coming down the aisle at the Garden. Jimmy and Johnny Valiant, they're the tag champs here at this particular point in time. And man, were those guys over his heels or what?
The two of them with Lou Albano were really I was trying to think of a word that would kind of encapsulate the Valiant Brothers, and I guess the word would be audacious. I think they just people were just in awe of them, although they were so flamboyant and so larger than life with Albano and crazy outfits, costumes, and crazy interviews, and they were heat magnets at the time. I was more familiar with their run they had later on in 79. John McAdam and I have gone over that a few times, and we were both very disappointed in that run. But it just, again, are you how can you catch lightning in a bottle? Sometimes you can, I guess, but it was just that initial run in the 74, 75 time frame where the Valiants just caught the imagination of New York. And they were able to replicate it in some other territories. I mean, they had already had a nice run in the WWA. But I think, in the between the time of this big run that they had and when they came back in 79, I think Billy Graham had a lot of that same pizzazz that they had, but he had the incredible body, which blew everyone away. And I think that may have pulled some of the steam out of the Valiants in New York, in my opinion.
I think Jimmy working as a single for a couple of years probably. I don't know. It seems like guys that are really, if they are really over as a single and they go into a tag team, that typically works well. But when a guy breaks out of a tag team and goes single and then tries to go back into a tag team, sometimes it just doesn't have the same chemistry that it did before.
Yeah,
Anyway,
and there was more to it too. I mean, in that run in 79, I think poor Jimmy had gotten Hep C and he was sidelined a bit. And then they brought in Guy Mitchell to be Jerry Valiant. And they just, the kind of the magic was gone. I mean, they tried to replicate the magic, it was just gone. But, just like Evan Ginsberg said, those guys were so likable. Johnny Valiant had his humor and they brought him back later to be a manager, Johnny V. Jimmy Valiant, really had a great second act of his career in the South, for Jim Crockett Promotions and some other promotions as well. I mean, he was just a great, great draw in the South and in Memphis too. And you have to give these guys credit. They endured a long, long time.
I think Jimmy is a great example of sometimes we don't read the wrestling match exactly right. Where we look at a Jimmy Valiant and we say, well, that guy, his work rate isn't very good. But I mean, he kept that feud with Paul Jones going for years and just kept going, and he was still over. He's still over now. And to me, that's a performer, right?
You're absolutely right. I'm the biggest fan of Dave Meltzer in the world. I love The Observer. The Observer enhanced my love of wrestling, but I think we have gone too much on this work rate thing. I mean, there are guys that are work rate proof, like a Jimmy Valiant. I mean, yeah, he wasn't a great technical worker if you're going by work rate, but he put butts in seats and people wanted to see him every week. It wasn't like, oh, I'd like to see him once or twice a year. He's one of those guys you want to see every week on the program. you know, you could say Bruno wasn't a great worker. Well, he could work because he could put butts in seats and people wanted to see him, and whatever he did, people loved. And, you know, there's not too many wrestlers you can say that about.
I mean, Jimmy Valiant is my example of, if he's a babyface, he works a match. If he's a heel, he works the same match. It's exactly the same. As a babyface, he still does the thumb to the throat,
right?
You know, and he still does the eye rake. But he's still over, and the fans still going crazy. So is that bad, or is that actually really good that he can do that? And I think
that's
it's
really
more.
Good.
I think it's more good than not good.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, to see him endure like that, I mean, again, I wasn't Dave Meltzer in 1979, but you know, if you had asked me as a kid watching this or as a teenager, I would have said, well, Jimmy Valiant has seen his better days. He's about ready to, you know, retire. But little did I know, he had this whole second act of his career, you know, the Memphis stuff and the Jim Crockett stuff and beyond. I mean, in school, I mean, he just had it, that it factor that we always talk about. And he was just somebody that even today people look back fondly on. And, you know, after watching some of the stuff I see on today's shows, I'd rather see a worker like him that's so basic, so simple. I mean, these guys are, you know, jumping off of three ladders and doing a triple moonsault. I mean, landing in a glass of water. It's just not as exciting as just seeing him drop an elbow on somebody. I mean, today's wrestling has gotten so out of hand.
Well, just to illustrate the difference in styles and what was acceptable to fans, what they would buy and what they wouldn't.
Right.
When I look at Jimmy Valiant in 75, he goes to some 30-minute time limit draws with some people. But then Jerry Jarrett, he says the worst mistake he ever made in Memphis was booking Jimmy with Nick Bockwinkel.
Right.
And the fans just couldn't buy Jimmy going that long with a worker like Bockwinkel because they were used to Jimmy's 7 to 10, 15-minute match where it's constant motion and the boogie-woogie and all of that. Whereas to go that long with Bockwinkel, it said to slow it way down. And in Memphis, that wasn't what the fans were interested in at all. But in
right.
the WWF, in some of these cities, they could buy that. They could buy Jimmy going that long with somebody and going with some, what I hate the term rest hold, but they had some of that, you know, where they'd lock down in a hold for a while.
Yeah. You know, every area was different. I mean, you know, we always hear about St. Louis. St. Louis was more sports oriented and you wanted things to be more legit. And, you know, Bruno had his style that he did in the Northeast really went over well. When he went to St. Louis, I think he learned that you had to work the St. Louis style, and he had that long hour draw with Harley Race, and he worked the St. Louis style, and people liked that match. I mean, I know Brian Last had a gentleman who's passed away that attended that match that was the best match he ever saw, Bruno against Harley, the one-hour draw. So, you know, I guess sometimes you have to work the type of match that area wants to see.
I think that happened to Superstar Graham too. I mean, I think he worked with Harley in St. Louis and it
right.
didn't exactly, the cake didn't rise, but then he goes to New York and he's, you know, it's fabulous. So
yeah. In New York, Superstar really meant a lot. And even when he came back in 87, when he was on fumes after his hip replacement, I mean, just the name Superstar Billy Graham. I mean, he practically crawled into the ring to face Butch Reed on one of those MSG shows, but still, you know, drew a great crowd, and the crowd was really into him. And so, again, another guy whose work resonated many years after the fact.
Tony Garea probably doesn't get the credit today of the being the star that he was back in this time and before. So he and Dean Ho have been in a program with the Valiants for a couple of years. What was your perception of Gurria and Ho?
Well, you know, I've read all these years of all these different tag teams that Tony was in, and I mean, I saw some of them. I saw the team with Zbyszko. I saw the team with Rick Martel. And I read a lot about the other teams, like the Ho team and the Calhoun team. You know, Tony was just this, you know, strong, silent type actor. Just a good-looking guy. And he was kind of that baby face for the female fans to root for and cheer for. And you know, he really delivered what he was supposed to deliver, I guess. Just the strong, silent type. But he was a man of few words on interviews. He was just a good-looking guy with a couple of tattoos, a lot of hair. I think the female fans were really into him. I know for us, you know, young guys watching, I mean, he was just a nice guy. I was, you know, happy for him when he won. But again, I rooted for the heels. I like the heels better. But he was a fine worker in the ring, and you know, those matches he had with Martel as his partner, and I've always heard very strongly that him and Ho were just, you know, box office and real babyface fan favorites in the early to mid 70s.
So we got in the spring here of 75, we have a tag title change. The Valiants put over Dominic DiNucci and Victor Rivera. And I mentioned earlier about the Barnett Australia stuff. The guy they picked to come right out of the box with was Dominic DiNucci. By 75 here, they put the tag straps on him and Rivera. What did you think of Dominic?
He was, back when I was a kid watching, I'm sure with my last name, liking Italian wrestlers came fairly easy for me. But he was always in that time frame. He was looked at as one of Bruno's boys, kind of like in Bruno's clique or posse or however you want to say it. But Dominic was a very big man, you know, a tall man. He was good for these tag teams. He had been kind of the guy that you would beat on before you'd have a match with Bruno. He would put over the opponent, put over whoever Bruno's next opponent was. But I liked DiNucci a lot in those days, and it doesn't surprise me, you know, all these years later to hear how important he was to Barnett in Australia, because apparently there was a huge Italian group of fans there that liked Italian wrestlers. And, and Dominic was a very good wrestler. I mean, he was kind of no frills, just your basics, the airplane spin, a lot of holds, a decent brawler. And Victor Rivera was probably one of the more technical wrestlers that we had. He was very agile. He did a cannonball move off the top rope. He was very agile. And I think that when they were doing the transition from Bruno to Koloff, I think actually Bruno wanted to have Victor be his replacement. But I think Monsoon and The Office wanted to go with Morales, and that's who they went with.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. You know, we hear all the time about Vince Sr., his connection with Eddie Graham. And in late 74, early 75, Dominic DiNucci and Tony Parisi actually get a run with the Florida tag team titles.
Right.
And I always kind of wondered why they didn't go with them to replace the Valiants rather than Victor Rivera. I just was curious about that, because they always put over Parisi as Sammartino's cousin, right?
Right.
And so I after they had that run in Florida for a couple of months, then they go back to WWF, but DiNucci gets the tag strap with a different partner, and I was always curious why they didn't go with Parisi.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I guess, you know, that's maybe testament to how over Victor Rivera was. But as you know, something unusual happened. They give Victor the title, and then quickly he basically resigns the title because he's going to the IWA.
Right.
And I've heard different things. Somebody said that he did an interview on TV where he said he was going to concentrate on winning singles titles, and that's why he wanted to leave. But anyhow, he did go to the IWA, and then Pat Barrett, who was a long time, more of a preliminary guy in WWF history, he came in to replace Victor, and they finished out their run before losing to the Black.
Yeah, just always kind of thought, well, they, Rivera was more of a singles and he was over, and so I just wondered why they put him in the tag team with DiNucci. And
Right.
yeah, I knew that there was some rumblings about him going to the other rival group or whatever. How long did he stay there, do you know?
The funny thing is, there's always been this hubbub about him leaving for the IWA. I've never seen him on any IWA results or cards ever. I mean, maybe I haven't been digging hard enough. I don't know if he ever ended up working on one of those shows, but considering what it cost him, I hope he did work on at least one or two of those shows.
Yeah, he did come out on television and give up the tag belt, didn't he?
That's right.
In an interview. So, well, there's another interesting character on some of these cards that I was curious about that I don't know that I've seen maybe before, is that's the Wolfman.
The Wolfman was Willie Farkas, and sometimes he'd be identified as the Canadian Wolfman. But he went way back to the early 60s with Bruno up in Canada. He was a Canadian wrestler. And Bruno in more recent times did say that Willie Farkas and Sweet Daddy Siki were two guys that he worked with in Canada that really helped give him the seasoning that made him a better champion when he did win the strap and when he defended against people. So he was a longtime Canadian wrestler, more of a journeyman wrestler here in the States. And he ended up working a lot with the Bear Man, Dave McKinney. And I think he even wrestled into the early 80s on some of those Bear Man McKinney shows, to about 81 or so.
Another character in here that is starting to hit the horizon of his career, Baron Mikel Cicluna, is still working on top here in
Right.
75.
Yeah. I'd say 75 was almost maybe the last year he kind of got somewhat of a push. After that, 76 to about 83, he's just strictly a prelim guy or jobber to the stars, as some people like to say. It's a shame. And he had been a bigger star in 67. He wrestled Bruno in the Garden. I think he even wrestled Morales in the Garden around 72 or so. He was a large man, and always in very fit and fit shape. And another guy that wrestled all over the world, had a great track record. Like a lot of guys, he wanted to be a homesteader, and he lived in Pittsburgh. And I guess he felt more comfortable making a lot less, but living at home in Pittsburgh and being there for his family when needed, and making a smaller paycheck, unfortunately.
This is also like either the second year, maybe, that Vince is the announcer on television. As a kid growing up, what was your impression of Vince Jr. on television?
Well, I think in recent years, a lot of people refer to the early Vince that we're seeing in this time frame with the yellow sport coat on.
Right.
They refer to him as kind of a Howard Cosell wannabe, and I think that's kind of who he's patterning himself after. I mean, Howard Cosell at the time, as Tony, he was a huge
Big
part
star.
of our culture at the time with
Yeah.
Monday Night Football and Battle of the Network Stars and all those other things he did. But Vince was like a Howard Cosell. He was very dramatic and had dramatic readings of certain things. And as time would go on, I think you'd see Vince get more comfortable and show a lot more of the Vince's personality. He definitely had a flair for the dramatic as time would go on, and you'd see a lot of that Vince personality come out in the early 80s, and then of course a lot more personality as he's owning the company and changing the look of wrestling as we know it.
I just remember as a kid in the 70s, our local radio station carried the ABC radio network, and at 7:25 in the morning, they'd run Speaking of Sports with Howard Cosell, fo followed by at 7:30 Paul Harvey.
Right.
And that was just a, you didn't miss it. You know, I mean, right. Howard Cosell from Wild World of Sports was just a huge, because coming out of the 60s and into the early 70s, he and Muhammad Ali had made such a impact on television that it made Howard, you know, it made him a super huge star in the sports world.
Oh, yeah. And he was so much a big part of ABC TV. I mean, he was on a lot of those episodes of The Odd Couple. He was on there with Felix and Oscar. And he was on, he did a Partridge Family. He did a lot of guest stints on different ABC shows. And, you know, he really had a unique charisma, Howard Cosell. You either loved him or hated him, but you couldn't ignore him.
I don't know if this might be her rookie year, but somebody I'm connected with on social media that I love her feed is Leilani Kai.
Oh, yeah.
And
yes.
She publishes so many great photos and yes. tells so many great stories. And she's in here mostly in tag matches because Moolah is in with her group, and Leilani Kai, Susan Green, and someone named Sheila Shepherd that I'm not so familiar with. But they're in tag. Leilani Kai is tagging with Moolah. What was your impression of women's wrestling at this time growing up?
You know, as a young kid who took the male wrestling really seriously, I think that the women's wrestling was really just not for me. I know John McAdam has gone as far as saying for him it was like bathroom break.
I see.
You know, I know he said that about being at live shows when there were female matches, but you know, times have changed so much. In those days, the girl wrestlers were very tough, and they put forth a great effort, but there really was next to zero sex appeal, or there wasn't much femininity so much. I mean, there were other wrestlers in the 70s who could do that. I know Susan Green in the magazines was very attractive, and Vicki Williams and Jerry Scrable were attractive. It really wasn't until kind of the earlier 80s when you had your Wendy Richter and you had Velvet McIntyre and other girls that were more, you know, kind of more feminine and more appealing to the eye, and also working a more modern approach rather than just the Moolah by the numbers approach.
I think we're kind of in a transition too for women's wrestling at this time in the 70s. I think in the 50s and the 60s, you had some ladies that could really work. And I think the quality of the matches in the 50s and 60s were probably a little bit better. I don't know. The 70s just seems like a dead period for women's wrestling. And I know Leilani, she got to be a more polished worker in the 80s and had some success. But when I think about Lorraine Johnson and Penny Banner, I mean, they could work. And they had some fabulous. Kay Noble. I just wrote a piece about a mixed tag match in 65 with Vern Bottoms and Fran Gravette, and they could work. And you had some ladies that could really work, you know, really strong matches. And I'm sure Moolah could work in the 50s and 60s, but here in the 70s, it just seemed like it was kind of a transition time till we get to the Wendy Richter era.
Well, it's funny. There was something, and I just learned this a year or two ago. There were a few times in the early 70s, I think it was more like maybe 73 or 74, where in some cities, I think it was Baltimore and maybe some other ones, they actually tried to do some cards where there were almost as many, or there were as many female matches as there were male matches.
Wow.
And WWF tried this back in that era, and it didn't last long. I mean, they just did it maybe once or twice. They may have had a battle royal, and then they had three or four female matches, and then maybe three or four male matches. I think it was unique that they tried that, but I think it was just more of an experiment than, hey, let's do this everywhere. Either that or it just didn't catch on.
So when you were just kind of looking through some stuff, thinking about coming on today and talking about this particular period of time, was there something that stuck out to you that you thought, oh, wow, I forgot all about that? Or, oh, my gosh, I didn't know that. Or there were names that you weren't familiar with, or any of that kind of stuff?
Well, a couple of things. One, I did see that Don Carnotto, very well known for being in the Carolinas in the early 80s, at the beginning of the early Starrcade era, he's on a show that blew my mind. I had no idea here in 75 he's in the WWWF. I
Yeah,
had no
I think this
idea.
is his rookie year, maybe.
Yeah, that blew me away. And then the other thing, and this kind of dovetails to what we've already been talking about, as far as Bruno Sammartino as a champion in this time period, there was a famous magazine cover. I think it was Inside Wrestling, and it had a picture of Bruno like suffering in the ring, and it had all these little bubbles surrounding him, and it said, the toll being the champion has taken on Bruno, and it said versus Duncombe versus Koloff versus Ladd versus Superstar versus Arion. So the time frame we're talking about, he goes from these major matches with Duncombe and Von Erich and Arion, and then the months that follow, he's going to wrestle Koloff and Superstar, and then the broken neck against Hansen, and then Brody, and then Patera, and then not far after that he finishes out his title reign. But to suspend disbelief, to buy into kayfabe, you can really believe that Bruno is putting his life in jeopardy against these major, major stars. A lot of them are much larger than him. Another thing that's interesting about this time frame we're talking about, the Bruno of the 60s and the early 70s was a much larger man. He was about 270, 275 pounds, just a big behemoth of a man. But by the time he comes back for the second reign, he dropped about 25 to 30 pounds. And he's much more aerodynamic, moves a lot better in the ring, not doing nearly as many power moves. I think his back was probably completely wrecked by this point in time. But so it's really interesting to just try to, take this all in, that Bruno had all these major contenders, and the fact that he was able to survive and get on with his life after this is really saying something.
Well, it reminds me as you were going through those names, and I looked at those too. And when you said, he kind of was his own talent, hit booker of his own talent, finding guys to, I mean, he did a tremendous job. I mean, finding those guys to line up for himself and then to do the matches he did to work in a way where it was believable and people thinking that he was facing all these. I mean, just you, when you were saying those names in my mind, I was thinking, wow, that's, quite a lineup for a champion
Oh, it
to
was.
face.
It was very, very impressive. And again, with the injury to Hansen, and again with the whole talent scout thing, Mike Padoucis, whose name we saw on some of those sheets from the mid of 75, he's an older journeyman wrestler who was friends with Bruno. And Mike Padoucis had recommended a talent he had seen in Texas, this young guy, Stan Hansen, who of course came out of Amarillo and came out of West Texas State. And we all know the Stan Hansen that we remember now from the mid 80s with teaming with Brody and the star of All Japan Wrestling. But here in the 70s, he's still becoming and evolving into Stan Hansen. And as the famous story goes, he's nervous. He's wrestling Bruno. They're going at a real fast pace at the Garden. They're both wet, dripping with sweat. And if you've seen the footage, I'm sure you have, he picks up Bruno for a slam and basically spikes Bruno on his head like spiking a football. And you can tell from watching the rest of the match that Bruno is concussed. He's staggering to get up to do the lariat. He does the lariat move with Hansen. He takes the blow. He blades himself. The match comes to a close, but you can tell he's concussed. You can tell he's staggering around the ring. And, again, I mean, these people that say wrestling is fake, well, maybe the outcomes are fake, but what they're doing to their bodies, what they're sacrificing for our entertainment is staggering.
What I find interesting about all this is looking back and knowing what Stan Hansen and Brody would become. in this time frame we're talking about, in the spring of 75, they're still in Oklahoma. And in 74 and 75, they've been the tag champs for Leroy McGurk.
Right.
And they're in their first generation. Like, so if you think about them generated in different generative versions, they're in their initial generation where Brody just has a goatee and Hansen has long blonde hair and a blonde goatee, and they're living out of their cars and they don't have enough to maybe eat but one time a day. Right. And they're struggling going to, from town to town on the less drawing end of this massive territory. And they're just struggling to get by, not having any idea what they would become in future years. I just think that's interesting to think about.
It's very interesting. I mean, it blows your mind when you think Stan Hansen went from, in his mind, thinking he'd made the biggest mistake of his life, injuring Bruno Sammartino unintentionally, to becoming maybe the greatest foreigner Japan had ever seen. And Bruiser Brody, a very similar story. He gets his name from the elder Vince, from what I know. He gets the Bruiser Brody name from Mr. McMahon Sr. And, you know, he has two big matches at the Garden with Bruno. Again, these are matches that haven't seen the light of day. Apparently, they weren't taped. I'm assuming they haven't been taped because they were never released. But that gave him the rub. Working with Bruno gave him the rub. He went to St. Louis. He went to other cities. He became bigger and bigger. And then he made the history in Japan. And you know what happened with Brody, but I mean the legacy is there. But you know, I enjoyed your show you had with that great promoter from St. Louis who has kept his name alive so much.
Herb Simmons.
It's staggering to think that, you know, as you so aptly said, to see them from stage one in New York, to see them go emerge into these other people is the 80s and years progress. It's amazing.
I've heard Stan say on occasion that experience in Oklahoma affected each of them differently.
Right.
Like it affected him to become even more determined to do whatever to be successful. And it affected Brody in a way where he became harder to work with.
Right.
With promoters, because he always remembered not being able to afford to eat and all the things he was being put through, and he maybe thought he should have been taken care of a little bit better. So he wanted to make sure he start taking care of himself in later years, which is right. the root of why he might have been a little hard for promoters to work right. with. And that's understandable. I mean, when you think about when you go through experiences, it affects people in different ways.
Yeah. But to think about, you know, Mr. Simmons in St. Louis, who still talks so highly of Brody today, I mean, he wouldn't be doing that if he didn't, you know, realize Brody's worth to the business and what he did to the business, not just giving his life, but, you know, those great performances in the ring. And you know, he made people believe in the business. He was always so genuine. So that's one of my fond memories of watching wrestling in this time frame. That first year or two of being a fan was seeing young Hansen and young Brody, and they even teamed a little bit at the end of their WWF run, and it was so magnificent to see them together, because you knew that they were going to become something really special.
I heard you recently on a podcast, you mentioned Meltzer earlier, who I also have a lot of respect for, but you talked about how the feeling you would get the day the Observer was supposed to come.
Right.
And I think that's what I'm trying to do with this show, is I'm trying to recreate those feelings we had back then while educating future generations that didn't get to experience it the way that we did in real time.
Those were incredible days.
I used to get the same feeling, by the way.
I mean, you look back on your life, I think you became a fan earlier than I did, but I became a fan in 76. So those first couple of years, 76, 77, when Bruno was the champ and Superstar was the champ, and I saw Hansen and Brody, those memories stand out to this day. But in the mid-80s, you know, when the national expansion happened and you're seeing that these guys who I grew up with, like Lou Albano, is becoming like this mainstream guy. Here he is in this video with Cyndi Lauper, and you're seeing, all these people that I grew up with are, in some way or another getting this focal point or getting attention. And then I discovered The Observer, and again, The Observer every, arrives usually on a Saturday. You get it, you take that staple out, and you start reading it. And every paragraph, I mean, I know there's people who don't like Meltzer, but for us, every paragraph, you're learning brand new things. Oh, Jerry Blackwell has left the
Oh,
AWA.
yeah.
Oh, someone has passed away. Oh, there's going to be a big show. Oh, I mean, like every paragraph, there was all this news about people jumping from promotion to promotion, or somebody's leaving, or and I love the readers' pages. That was my favorite part.
Me
Is
too. I loved
I
it.
just love the readers' pages because you'd have like 3 pages of letters, and they would have people just like us talking about, well, this resonated with me, and this meant something to me, or I really like this, or I hated this, and that part really made me happy. I mean, it was like it was like we have this camaraderie of fans, and we're all sharing little dribs and drabs of things, and Meltzer's giving all of his point of view. It was just like the happiest time to be a fan, I think.
Oh, I'm just like you, and I remember feeling so good there were other people like me. Like, oh my gosh, I still remember I would get excited over Steve Menari from St. Louis. He
From
would
St.
write
Louis,
some of the
wasn't he?
great pieces in their letters about things, and
Oh, yeah.
just different people. And I would think, oh man, there's other people that love this stuff as much as I do. Like, this is really cool. And Dave, I mean, let's face it, we wouldn't have a lot of the wrestling media we have today. I mean, he was a pioneer in some of that stuff. There were newsletters before him and all that, but I mean, he was really a key figure, and I respect him for that. I mean,
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you one little transition here that's kind of humorous to me, at least. We've talked about my entire journey of being into wrestling, and this is like 9 or 10 years ago. I 9 or 10 years ago, other than seeing it on TV occasionally, I really was not involved with wrestling whatsoever. So I started a new job 9 or 10 years ago, and I got the worst shift possible. I got like a midnight to 8 a.m. shift. So this is right at the very, very beginning of podcasts, right when they're just becoming a thing. And I'm noticing that there's some wrestling ones out there, and I discovered this thing called the 605 Super Podcast, which is Brian Last, and he started that, and I'm listening to them every week, and he's putting out like one a week. And his show is so cool because it's kind of like The Observer in that he'll find a guy who's like on the fringe of wrestling, or involved in wrestling in some way, and brings them onto the show, and they have an interview, like kind of like what we're doing now, for 45 minutes or whatever. And then he'd bring on somebody completely different from another part of wrestling, or then he'd have like a comedic bit, like based on like Howard Baum being the Magnificent Morocco or something like that. So that really hooked me. And then I heard about the Arcadian Vanguard Network, that he had other shows, and John McAdam had a show with Sean Goodwin, doing this show about more focusing on the Northeast wrestling scene, but also the other part of wrestling. And John and I had corresponded a little bit, in years gone by, like on Kayfabe Memories or Wrestling Classics, and so we knew each other a little bit, but. When I made contact with him, he says, "Hey, I really want to have you on my show because you would be good, and we could talk wrestling, we could talk WWF, blah blah blah." And eventually, we did it. We did it once or twice. His original guy, Sean Goodwin, had to drop out, I think, because of scheduling. And eventually, he said, "Would you like to become a full-time guest host?" And I said, "Sure." And we've been doing this for a long time, and I really enjoy it. We have a Facebook group. We have a lot of people participate, and I've met a lot of people that way. Nice people like yourself, and it's just so much fun. It's kind of like that. It's kind of like that Saturday getting your Observer. You're taking your staple out, but you're connected to this wide group of people. So it's a lot of fun.
And what's great about it is it's the name of the show is Stick to Wrestling, and you guys don't always. Then that's great.
Well. We talk about pizza and some things like that, but or The Sopranos, but it's mainly wrestling, and we like it like that.
You bet. Yeah, you guys do a great job. It's on the Arcadian Vanguard Network. It's called Stick to Wrestling. John McAdam and Steve Generelli, you should check it out. And Steve's going to be on here with me. We're going to be talking about WWF on my show from time to time. And one other thing before I let you go, you've been so generous with your time to hang out with me today. You mentioned somebody that we are not probably going to be mentioning any time. I don't know when we would ever mention them again, but I just posted a picture of them here a day or two ago and got all this reaction because people were not familiar with the Love Brothers. And right. you mentioned the Love Brothers. You saw them at a different federation, but talk a little bit about the Love Brothers, because I don't think they get remembered as well as they deserve either.
Well,
Hartford and Reginald.
It was saying about the Love Brothers, I got to give a shout out to Bob Smith, who's had me on the show a few times, Outdated Wrestling Hour, a really great guy. Bob had grown up in Albany, and he saw a lot of the NWF, which eventually kind of became the IWA. And the Love Brothers were really popular in that federation. And they were two guys that were essentially like hippie wrestlers. And I guess the idea was, just because they're hippies, they're heels. You have to hate these guys. Mm-hmm. They're not part of the establishment, I guess. And, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, you would think that the wrestling fans would be more accepting of these hippies.
Right.
But they were supposed to be hated heels. But they were in some ways kind of like the Valiants. They were wearing different clothing. They were
different. Peace sign variety Love Brother heels, right? All of that 60s culture stuff.
And again, in that heyday, I guess, and I was just a kid back in the early 70s, it was like, maybe there was a legitimate tension between the hippies and the establishment, but that's what they were aiming for. And I think, from what I've seen on the TV shows I've seen, I mean, they did get heat. People really hated
they
them,
did.
So it worked.
They were really over in Maple Leaf Gardens and Detroit. They were over big time, but not remembered today as much as I think they probably should have been for the impact they had back in that day, for sure.
Absolutely, and I know you're writing some great wrestling books in the near future. I would love for somebody to kind of tackle the NWF, or even a book about the evolution of the Pittsburgh promotion, because it's like, that's always such a mystery. And I know some people have shed some light on it, but it's always an interesting area to look at.
And that was Pedro Martinez, right? He bought it from somebody. I can't remember. I'm not real strong on that history, but I remember he was the promoter there for 3 or 4 years. And he had some strong stars, even had a relationship with Inoki in Japan.
Right. That's
and,
right. Yeah. Johnny Powers too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you bet. All right. Steve Generelli has been my guest today. Steve, thank you so much for coming.
It's been a pleasure, Tony. Great to get to know you a little bit better, and great to share some wrestling talk with you. And I hope to do it again someday.
You bet we will. We'll do it again really soon. We've been talking about WWF in 75, and we'll be back with more coming soon. Well, I hope you enjoyed sitting in on our visit today, taking a trip back in the pro wrestling time tunnel. Hey, visit my Substack channel at TonyRichards4. Subscribing to my newsletter helps support the work I do to preserve pro wrestling history. Plus, you get it in your email inbox every single morning, and you never miss an issue of the newsletter or a podcast if you have a free subscription. If you have a paid subscription, that supports my work even more, and you'll get special stuff in the vault. Updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book, which is coming along really, really nicely. I'm close to the end of the research phase and about to start the writing phase later on this fall. I appreciate your investment of time in our show today, and I hope you like and subscribe our podcast and our newsletter. And until next time, bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast. Tune in for another great episode next week, interviewing wrestlers, referees, and media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great. Be sure to follow us on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. We'll release a new episode soon. Don't you dare miss it.